As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm delighted today to be joined by John McKenzie.
Hello.
How are you doing, buddy?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, good. Excited about the podcast?
Very.
Good stuff. Well, I'm excited too because you and I are joined by baby boy Pinder. It's Reuben Pinder.
The cherub return.
How are you doing, buddy? Okay.
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm lovely. Well, now, listen, it's a salty beginning. We are here today. We'll be joined by Seb Stafford-Bloor a bit later to talk about some serious adult stuff. But before we get to that, so much to go through today. My first question was going to be, has anything happened since I went away?
Podcast got better.
Yeah. Oh, I don't doubt it. Liverpool-Arsenal will discuss that big game of the weekend. Or, well, was it the biggest game? Who could say? Because Wrexham also played. So we discuss Wrexham a little bit later on in the podcast. Daddy Frank Lampard is home. We talk about him and granddaddy Hodgson, who we talk about also. That's Crystal Palace there. Bruno Fernandes, deep in the depths of the midfield of Manchester United. And, of course, the Reuben Pinder-John McKenzie derby happened. That's Crystal Palace Leeds was a sort of flash result there too. We also learn how to properly say the word harbinger and the definition of that. And John does some Latin, don't you, John?
I did a bit of Latin, yes.
Thrill for you,
yes,
buddy.
You really spoiled me.
Yeah. Now, listen, if you want to be spoiled and or spoil another, you should visit The Athletic. TheAthletic.com/TIFO. TheAthletic.com/TIFO, where I believe in my absence last week, Adam Crafton blew the roof off the place by publishing a piece all about some freedom of information request emails from the government. Yeah? Now, that sounds boring. It certainly sounds more boring than the first read I did, but that one was changed for legal reasons. Anyway, it isn't boring, and we talk about that extensively with Seb Stafford-Bloor in today's podcast. So if you are not a subscriber to The Athletic and you would like to read Adam's piece, as I highly encourage you to do so, then do visit theathletic.com/TIFO, where you can avail yourself of a 30-day free trial to trial for free for 30. Okay, fine. Are we ready to go? In which case, I will leave you with the warm hands and the cool embrace of the smallest, tiniest little baby. It's Reuben Baby Boy Pinder.
We can't do that every time.
We can, and we will. Okay. How little you know, Joe.
Hot diggity dog! Liverpool 2.
I did it wrong.
Yes,
I won.
I finally did it right. Imagine that.
Stick with it.
Liverpool 2, Arsenal 2. What a game this was for the neutral, as I believe they say. I can't imagine it was much fun for either Liverpool or Arsenal fans. But John, a game for the neutral.
A game for the neutral and a game for the tacticians as well.
Was it?
Quite interesting. Yes, I thought so.
I thought second half very hard to analyse. First half a bit easier.
Yeah, second half
devolved, let's say. But the first half, the interesting thing that happened was that Liverpool started inverting Trent Alexander-Arnold really early in the build-up, which they've not really done before.
No.
And yeah, I made a video looking at why that might have been the case. But against teams who build out from the back, Arsenal have a really aggressive press. So my supposition is that part of the reason was just to break the structure of their press a little bit, get Alexander-Arnold into situations, slightly different situations. So not only in possession, because we all know about inverting fullbacks, but out of possession, he was doing a lot of transitioning into the back line in behind Konate. So Konate was quite far out wide, and then Alexander-Arnold was dropping into the space between him and Virgil van Dijk.
Almost in the kind of where you would expect a centre-back to be.
Yeah, I mean, in a defensive transition moment, often what will happen is if your fullback is advanced up the field, even if they're playing traditional wide role, your centre-back comes out wide to a player getting in behind them and they drop in behind. But
or a midfielder drops in there, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas I think in this situation, maybe reduces the amount of space that Alexander-Arnold has to travel back to to actually help out. But yeah, for me, that was mainly about... Well, it's the reason why you invert fullbacks, right? That you change the structure in possession, you allow access into your wide player a lot easier because you make the opposition's forward press quite narrow. The problem was that they were playing like Arsenal. The problem was is that Arsenal very quickly just changed the pressing shape. So the idea was, I think, to pull Martinelli out of the wide areas. But after about 5 minutes, Arsenal just put Martinelli out on Konate rather than on Alexander-Arnold, and then they sort of shifted their press around a little bit.
Quite impressive that they did that within 5 minutes, right? I mean, does that show Arteta's, I don't know, sort of ability to make decisions quickly?
I think that because Liverpool were playing the structure that Arsenal usually play, I don't think it would have been that hard for the Arsenal players to get their heads around what happened there. So they'll know why they're doing it. So it will just be a case of them being like, well, we know why we do it. Let's just move things around. They went a little bit more aggressive. They had, I think, Gabriel pressing on Salah rather than Zinchenko, and then Zinchenko coming inside so that Xhaka could push forward onto Trent Alexander-Arnold. So they just sort of shuffled everything around. And then it just became a question of like who is better at building up out of that shape.
For most of the first half, that was Arsenal.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So, yeah, the idea of, I think, inverting your fullback is that you make the build-up shape quite narrow. It opens up spaces in the wide area, so you have better access to your wide players if you want to. And if you're a team like Arsenal, you've got someone like Zinchenko inverting, you can actually build up through the middle quite nicely as well, because he's good on the ball in that situation. And I don't think that Trent Alexander-Arnold's skill set maybe lent itself as much to that. Mm. In the second half, I thought that Liverpool made a few changes to help themselves out, because one of the things I noted in the video is that you were seeing the wide player's passing the ball into Salah. He's receiving back to goal and the defender's right up behind him. So it's really hard for him to turn and actually get any benefit from having easy access to the ball. Whereas with Arsenal, what they do is this thing that Arteta's been doing all season, which is dropping across and making a run so that you and the ball end up moving in the same direction. So it's a much more dynamic way of receiving the ball. Mm. It helps you progress the ball more. And they actually did that for their goal. In the second half, Liverpool started dropping out the eights a little more into the wider areas, so that helped them progress the ball down the field. They also got a goal towards the end of the first half, right, which meant that it was that right, 1-1 at half time?
It went in 2-1 at half time.
2-1 at half time, sorry, yeah. Of course, because Arsenal went 2-0 up, yeah. Mm. And I think once the goal difference got to only was reduced to just one, I think Arsenal started feeling the pressure, so they naturally started sitting a little bit deeper as well, which aided Liverpool's ability to progress the ball. And yeah. I think towards the end of the second half, it felt like watching Liverpool last season when they would just force teams back. They were able to progress the ball, so teams just got forced back.
Yeah.
And then it's just a case of trying to break down that low block.
Well, I want to come back and discuss that a bit more, but staying with the first half for now, it did feel, Ruben, as though Arsenal had the opportunities in the first half to maybe sew the game up. I'm not so certain that there were that significant a number of very clear-cut chances, but in terms of Saka and Martinelli running in behind, it felt like they probably could have scored four in the first half.
Yeah, and it also felt like every time the ball went over Trent's head, as every team does, as John was kind of explaining, Konate would get dragged out wide. And for the second goal in particular, you can tell that Van Dijk is kind of... and Robertson are stuck in this odd position. Gabriel Jesus exploits it really well. But if the defensive line, if Konate hadn't rushed out there and Trent was able to cover that space, then maybe Van Dijk would be in a better position to defend that cross. But yeah, Arsenal fans will have said before the game, if we go to Anfield and get a point, like, that's not bad, because their record there was pretty poor beforehand. And it, you know, this season, you don't really know what Liverpool you're going to get. This felt like the team that beat United 7-0, but Arsenal being much better than Man United, rather than the Liverpool team that just kind of doesn't do anything this season. So they'll be happy in a sense with that point, but the fact that they went 2-0 up and they were really dominant in the first kind of 30, 40 minutes, and they had other chances as well. There was the big switch from Jesus to Saka that then he got back at the far post. If that goes in, then it could be completely different.
There was a moment in the game as well, a much discussed moment, Ruben, where Xhaka and Trent Alexander-Arnold clashed, had a bit of a barney, and according to all, it lifted the Anfield crowd, which is the only thing required for Liverpool to score goals. It turns out it's just all you need is people in the crowd to... I mock that. Of course, I understand the impact that can have on a football team. What did you make of that? Because the commentary team were very clear that Xhaka was a big old fool.
Well, that is the narrative with Xhaka, isn't it? But he's done a lot fewer foolish things this season because he's playing in a better system that protects him, and he's probably just grown up a little bit. But initially I felt very stupid after the game because I thought that was quite clever from Xhaka to just provoke Trent Alexander-Arnold enough to get him booked, and then you leave him unable to really put a tackle in on Martinelli because he might get sent off,
which may well have been what the intention was.
So that he probably thought he was being smart, but then there's the whole intangible atmosphere kind of thing. But then the statistics, pre Xhaka's yellow card and Trent's yellow card at the same time, Liverpool had only had 4 shots. I don't think any of them were on target. Post Xhaka's yellow card, they had 17 shots.
Yeah.
Quite a few of them were on target. So it did kind of shift the momentum of the game. But yeah, if only we could quantify how much the cop sucking the ball into the net actually mattered.
Can we?
You know? No.
They're working on a model, I'm sure.
Damn it. Opta are on it, yeah.
XD, expected decibels.
I did think that, like, a lot of the narrative was sort of angled at the beginning by the fact that obviously Arsenal are very good, they're top of the league. I didn't think that Liverpool were as bad as people were suggesting. I think as soon as the first goal went in, everyone was like, oh, here we go, it's Arsenal doing their thing. I thought it was quite a balanced game where Liverpool got caught out in a couple of defensive situations, which we know is what they're not very good at this season, right? They play such an aggressive line that they have to be super on the triggers of when the line pushes up and drops back. They also have to be really aggressive on the opposition ball players to make sure it's hard for them to play it over the back line. And I think that's where they've been let down a little bit this season. But in terms of what they were doing in possession, I thought they were doing some good stuff. And I think that was then exacerbated by this idea that they had nothing, and then suddenly this event happened. And then they got good. I don't think it's quite so simple as that.
I always find it interesting to talk to you. And I used to find it interesting to talk to Alex Stewart about these things too. You being someone who dispassionately analyses football from the perspective of a tactician, looking for what's happening on the field and or imagining what the kind of coach instructions are in order to try to understand what's happened, right? But then there are some things that, because as Ruben said before, some things you can't quantify, the Anfield crowd being one of them, you know, whether a player's having an on day or an off day as an example of. But Liverpool this season, I asked you about it over the weekend, and I asked you what's going on with them, and you gave me like an on-pitch response, which was accurate, I thought, yeah? But what it missed was, like, I think that they're mad, right? There's like a psychological element to this, which is not easy or possible really to quantify in the data or to be completely certain about. We can only guess, I suppose. But it doesn't make sense to me that this team can be, look as shaky as they did in moments in that game in the first sort of 30 minutes or so. And they did have good moments too, but they, as Ruben mentioned before, like at times they look like the team that beat Man United 7-0. At times they look like the team that's lost whatever, how many games this season. That game totally could have gone either way. Like, I don't know, do you think they're in their own heads or something? Like, what is the possible psychological scenario?
Weirdly, I do think momentum mattered in that game.
Yeah.
Because I think the reason why Liverpool enjoyed the second half is because Arsenal were doing something different, which is they weren't pressing as aggressively and causing them those problems. So whenever any of these things happen, I'm always thinking about the game state because, you know, we've seen Liverpool being great in games this season. We've seen Liverpool be awful in games this season. I can't just simply explain it away by being like, well, this is just a psychological thing entirely.
No.
What I think a lot of it comes down to is when they are able to do the things that they're really good at doing, then they're great. And when teams find those aspects which they struggle with, they're really not great. And yeah. I think that maybe the on-pitch explanation that I gave to you when we talked about it over the weekend was that Jurgen Klopp has a very, I don't want to say one-dimensional because that sounds patronising, but he has a very set idea about the way that he wants his team to play.
It's a consistent approach.
Yeah, and they've lost a few players this season. They've got players getting older. So Virgil van Dijk's had an ACL injury and recoveries in that period. Things like that impact the way that they play. And if they don't have the players who are able to play at the peak level that they were at in the previous seasons, then you start seeing a drop-off. And it's one of those things as well where it's not just a slight decline. It's like either you can press aggressively and you can stop opponents from targeting your high line, or you can't. And if you can't, then they just go over the top of the your back line over and over again and cause you problems against isolated against the back line itself.
When they were like really, really good, they used to almost get caught out with runs in behind their defence constantly. And then Van Dijk would just put his arm up and the flag would go up and they'd be like, "Whoa, that was close." It's like, no, it was offside. That was the intention. And now if that just works less frequently, then it creates loads of problems.
I remember
it's a bit like fine margins.
It is. And there is also an element of the 7-year, not curse, but you know how at Mainz and Dortmund, similar things happened where energy levels sapped because the squad had reached the end of a kind of cycle. A lot of players were pushing 32, 33. And then all of these tiny little things kind of add up.
I remember Liverpool fans used to get really annoyed because people would think that opposition teams had been better because they would remember the amount of offside chances that they had against them. And that, I mean, that's on the one hand, that's true, right? If, you know, an offside chance doesn't count. It was not a legal way of trying to score a goal. But
it was illegal.
It was illegal, exactly. But if you start getting those fine margins wrong, suddenly all of those chances do become legal. So it's almost a sense in which that was a harbinger of what was to come. Because
Harbinger. People say different things,
soft,
don't they?
Soft G, I reckon.
You think soft G? Mm.
Harbinger.
Steve Hanke?
Harbinger.
Harbinger. Harbinger.
Yeah, get wrecked. That's 3-1
Jamie's
on you.
Saying Harbinger. 4-1.
Four?
Wow. I've been saying Harbinger these whole... Sometimes I say Harbinger as well.
You're just ungovernable, aren't you?
Ungovernable. Yeah. Ungovernable. Speaking of ungovernable, Granit Xhaka, I just want to return to momentarily. Because I've got a thought about this. I think things too. You know?
You tweeted at the weekend.
I know, and I regretted it. It was a mistake. But I thought, as soon as I saw this incident happen, and for people who didn't watch the game, Arsenal have been attacking. They're on the left wing. They're kind of working it towards the box. And then Liverpool do a successful defend, as you call it in football. But Xhaka decides, who's just chasing slightly after Trent Alexander-Arnold, It looks as though he decides, oh, I'm just going to leave a little bit in anyway. And he kind of nudges him a bit. I think it's very minor. I don't think it's anything to be concerned with, personally.
It was cynical.
It was cynical. And I think it was a yellow card. But I don't think it wasn't as though, you know, he didn't sort of, you know.
It wasn't like he elbowed someone in the face, right?
He didn't elbow anyone in the face. Mm. No, he didn't do that. No. Anyway, it's something that you would expect the referee to stop play for and, you know, perhaps issue a yellow card and a telling off. And, you know, there you go. It's also something I think you would expect from maybe a fair number of players. But in this situation, I think it's Granit Xhaka's reputation that kind of precedes him here. And the commentary team, who incidentally are excellent, by the way, and this is not a dig against the commentary team, but they all sort of very quickly decided, I think, that, oh, that's Granit Xhaka, that's the kind of thing he does. It's really stupid. It's going to lead to blah, 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 blah. You know, you can see the Anfield crowd lifted immediately and Liverpool players seemed suddenly really up for it. Trent Alexander-Arnold rushed back in towards him and they had a little stagging headbutt thing, the thing they like to do with their heads. You know, it's very sweet, isn't it? I felt like the narrative of the game was perpetuated throughout the kind of following 10 minutes and at half time, where the finger was being pointed directly at Granit Xhaka and his sort, as though like someone could have told you before the game that he would have done the thing that turned the game. And it was almost as though people thought Granit Xhaka directly, specifically caused that first Liverpool goal and prevented Arsenal from winning with 3 points. Just to make the point clearly, I'm not saying that that incident didn't change the game. I think it's very clear that it did. I'm just saying I think people were because of who Granit Xhaka is and his reputation, made a little bit much about that. And perhaps it was too easy and delightful a narrative to not.
It's like reductive, isn't it?
I think it's post hoc ergo proctor hoc. That's what it is.
Or whatever he just said.
John McKenzie and his $10 phrases. Hey, go on.
Post hoc ergo proctor hoc.
Post-frock, ergo hoc, proctor-frock. Are you speaking pig Latin?
After that.
I think he's speaking.
Oh, you can say it in English.
Ergo, therefore, propter hoc, because of that. So it's this idea that because things happened after an event, they must have been causally linked to that event.
I see. And is the rule when you learn that you have to repeat it in Latin?
If you can say it in Latin, it's better, isn't it?
Is it better? Yeah.
Or did Latin or
what? You're the kind of guy at parties where you say something and then people go, what's that? What's that? Yeah,
you're
I'll just explain. Hold on.
West Wing, right?
I did enjoy The West Wing, although having watched it twice, I never finished it.
Yeah, I've not finished it either, but very early on, there's an episode, I think, that is titled Post Hoc Ergo Proctor.
Is that where you learned it?
That's where I learned
from
it.
From mainstream culture.
Mainstream culture.
You're the kind of guy...
Actually, I'm cool.
You soak up these smart things, but from, like, just normal places.
Yeah, exactly.
But then you present as though you learned it at university.
I wasn't reading Erasmus, no, I was watching...
What's Erasmus? Stop putting in references that make
Erasmus.
Me feel stupid.
That's the father of the...
That's the study abroad scheme.
You know
is
as well?
Named after a man?
Harbinger.
Yeah, it is, oh, right, actually, yeah.
That makes sense.
It's my Harbinger. Okay, fine. One other thing we should say, Ruben Pender, on this game is Aaron Ramsdale. Terrific performance.
Very good.
And towards the end there, made a couple of crucial saves.
Yeah, the Canate one right at the end that caused the double screech from Carragher and Neville was...
And Neville went into proper Fernando Torres mode, didn't he? That?
Goalgasm mode.
The goalgasm.
That save, I felt kind of bad for Canate there because it's at that horribly awkward height where he's thinking, I'm going to head this, and then it doesn't come up high enough. Yeah. So he has to like kind of try and chest it into that. But yeah, Ramsdale was excellent. And the deflected one from, was it a Saka shot? Salah. Unreal. But yeah, they do miss Gabriel Saliba at the back. Thought Holding is doing his best, but he's not quite at that level.
For sure.
The clumsy penalty, things like that. Mm. But yeah, Ramsdale was good. What about the, are we gonna discuss Elbowgate?
Yeah, I mean, we probably should talk about Elbowgate, shouldn't we?
Mm. What happened?
So the lino is walking over to...
The assistant referee. Really.
Yeah, I love that he just goes straight with lino there. It's not even linesman. He's like, lino,
Lino is gender neutral.
He's doing the opposite of you. You're trying to appear more smart. He's trying to appear less smart.
Upwardly and downwardly converging.
Yeah, it's interesting.
We've got something for everyone. All
that's
of our
true.
Listeners love us.
Yeah.
Half of them hate me, half of them hate him. It's fine.
Yeah, that's true. And all of them hate me.
So the assistant referee is walking over to their colleagues, peers. And
we're making him double think everything.
Yeah. And Robertson...
Andrew Robertson.
Andrew Robertson taps him on the arm or appears to hold his arm.
Yes.
And for what it looked like to me was the assistant referee lifted their arm to shrug the player off.
Yeah, don't touch me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's self-defense without even any real intention
of
aggression.
Yeah. This guy studied judo.
He is absolutely hench as well, which
probably
didn't help.
Studied judo?
I don't know. I'm just making things up.
That would be a great one, though, wouldn't it?
Well, I believed it because he's in great shape. And then... He caught Robbo.
He's talking about the linesman, not you.
Yeah, yeah, just to clarify. We're not going to HR afterwards. He caught Robertson on the chin, which is understandable. Nobody enjoys being whacked in the face in any way, right? It's like
some people do.
You see, well, each to their own.
Hey, listen, we've all seen 50 Shades of Grey, am I right? Speaking of high class culture. Please
keep going.
Anyway.
Plow on.
We'll interrupt you more, but carry on.
And then... Robertson is understandably frustrated and kicks off, and Henderson is like going over to speak to the referee, etc. But this clamour to like sack this referee because he did that, I think it's like, yes, players shouldn't touch referees. If Robertson doesn't touch him, he doesn't get an elbow to the chin accidentally.
Yeah.
And this is all within the context of a culture where referees are now almost terrified of players after, you know, the Mitrovic stuff that we discussed recently and the Bruno Fernandes one. It's like, just don't touch the ref and that won't happen. So I can kind of understand he's not even looking. He doesn't know where he is. He's not looking. Mm-hmm. He does that and it's an accident. So they've like stood him down while they investigate the incident. But
personally, I think he should be set on fire and all of his family should be murdered. That's what I think. But I don't know. I'm glad I don't make the decision.
Well, seems coincidentally, that is what you wish had happened.
It's what I wish had happened, yeah.
We were talking about this yesterday, Ruben and I, when we were hanging out because we're friends.
That's right. You went for a brunch, didn't you?
We did, yeah. And we were saying that the concept of violence in football is like a weird one because people only seem to consider violence to be physical violence.
Yeah.
And yet, obviously, there is a scale of violence. So we were talking about how in the legal system, you have assault and you have battery. And assault is the threat to violence.
Yeah.
And battery is actually enacting that violence on someone, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like assault, battery. As soon as it hits you, it's battery, right?
Right.
I feel as though in football we...
I'm clipping that later.
We should be clear this doesn't constitute legal advice.
But if you want legal advice, JJ and I do have a fantastic company that you should consult. But we were saying in football, the assault aspect is not...
It's never ending.
Yeah, essentially footballers can get in a referee's face and scream and swear in their face.
Yeah.
Which I think if you did that outside of a football field, it would be constituted possible assault.
Sure. Also, not to pick on him, Robertson is a bad offender for that, I feel like, with assistant referees, because he's always near the touchline.
It's the ones near the touchline,
He's always barking at them. Mm.
But the thing that frustrates me is that they have this context where it's almost like it's okay for you to be... like verbally violent in the faces of other people.
That's right.
But then as soon as it goes over this line, people are suddenly like, oh, this is
the imaginary line that we've drawn in society, though, isn't it? That's how we keep society at its phrase.
It's properly glued together. It's like sticks and stones applied to
it is,
sport, isn't it?
But it's important as a cultural tapestry because you have to draw the line somewhere. And I do think if you have
you think it's fine for
millions of people
shout,
who are baying for blood on a daily basis. And I'm one of them. You know, those three or four people I've seen today, love to murder them. Absolutely love to. Would love to get out there and get them... and murder them.
Are you saying that famously, the only thing that is stopping you from shouting in my face and then punching me is
the illusion of society. That's right. No. And the rules that hold the tapestry together. We're all framed, you know. As soon as you touch somebody, I don't think it's a perfect system. Having said that, I do think, I did imagine that too before I realised that the referee was just turning around and saying, take your hand off me. I thought, yeah, give him one for me as well. Not really. I don't condone violence.
But you do enjoy it.
My point is more that if you are allowing people to be violent to a certain point and then saying you can't go beyond that point, you can't be surprised when people get so annoyed that they get to that point and then overstep the mark.
Well, of course, it's all meaningless, isn't it? It doesn't matter. Yeah. It's just pretend. Yeah, these arbitrary rules that we've drawn for ourselves as a society.
Isn't it mad that in ice hockey they allow the players to fight?
I quite like it.
I know, I quite like it as well, but I do find it like astonishing.
Do you think we should do that in football?
Do you think we should
just get Alexander-Arnold and Xhaka, just be like, fine, square
you'd
up.
You'd have to get like amateur boxing helmets on them.
Well, you give them 5 seconds before you intervene. You know, and also you have to opt in.
That.
You have to opt in. It's only consenting fighters, right? If before the game you're saying, I'm not a fighter, I'm a lover.
The clubs are their multi-million pound assets. Like, yeah, sure, that's 5 seconds, let's go at it. Like,
that's true.
Wail on one another.
£80 for Kylian Mbappe, perfect. Oh, he's a fighter. No, he can't pay that much money. The insurance will be
He's very angry.
Yeah. No, maybe they should organise some sort of secret fight club situation where they can all, fight each other underground.
They're not even allowed to go skiing. I can't imagine that this will fly.
Well, skiing is ridiculously dangerous. You know, we're talking about violence is one thing. Skiing, that's just ridiculous.
Yeah,
guys.
I'm still can't believe the fact that Manuel Neuer actually did that, didn't he?
Yeah,
he broke his feet.
I can't believe that people do that. They stand on things and go down.
Have you not been skiing?
No.
No, you must ski.
I must ski,
as they say. No, it is great.
Is that where you learn Latin when you go
skiing?
That's
right. I decline nouns as I'm going down the slopes. Right. A mo, a mass, a mat.
There we go. Fine. Steve Hankey's dropped something in the chat before we move on. The origin of the word harbinger. Well, I'm saying that correctly now. Harbinger is a Middle English from the old French harbergere, which roughly translates as to provide lodging for. Well, that's exciting, isn't it? The term originally denoted a person who provided lodging, later one, who went ahead to find lodgings for an army or a nobleman and his retinue. Is that how you say that?
Retinue.
Retinue.
If you say all of the letters in the correct order, you'll get it.
Retinue. Retinue.
Sounds like a bit of a long-winded version of explaining an estate agent / landlord.
That's true. Yeah. Although lodging, very different sort of rules for lodging.
Presumably they were a harbinger because they would turn up before everyone else and be like, the army's coming.
Yeah. Well, that's true. You only really get a harbinger of doom in the cliche, don't you?
Well, you guess you could have an harbinger of happiness.
Could you?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah. You're a bit of a harbinger of happiness,
thanks,
aren't you?
Man.
I expect the happiness to arrive once you've left. Yeah. Perfect.
Can we talk about the title race? Because we haven't mentioned it yet.
We probably should, because of course, as the listener, I imagine, knows, they're a football enthusiast. Of course they have all the information already. This really threw the title race into a sort of a bit of an unbalance there, John. Why is that?
There's 6 points now between Manchester City and Arsenal. Manchester City have a game in hand, and Manchester City and Arsenal have to play.
Mm.
Manchester City have a better goal difference, so if Manchester City beat Arsenal and both teams win all of their games, it then comes down to whoever scores the most goals in the remaining fixtures.
That's true, yeah. Although, interestingly, you said if Manchester City beat Arsenal but both teams win all of their games.
Apart from that game.
That can't happen, can it? That can't happen. Yeah, but what you mean is if Arsenal win all of their games except that one. That's what you meant to say, wasn't
it? I'm struggling.
Essentially,
on that
City are top of the league.
Society.
Theoretically,
that society imposed boundary between assault and battery right now.
Now, it? I said some weeks ago, cool guy as I am, that I thought Manchester City were going to win the treble.
Did you say that on here?
I definitely said that
said
to
it to
you.
Me. You did say it
I
to
think
me.
I said it on here, Steve Hankey.
I'm not remembering it.
You don't, no, I don't think you did. I'm gonna pretend you never said
it. No, don't do that. I text it to you. I'll find it. I said it about a month ago, maybe even
we
more.
We definitely talked about
6
it.
6 weeks ago, I think
said,
I said it.
You said you
I said, I just got a funny feeling. One of those texts where, you know, it's a win-win because if it happens, I look amazing. If it doesn't, you just forget I said it, so it's fine. Ruben Pinder, after this game, my prediction feels a little more likely, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, especially when you look at City Southampton.
Yeah. We should say before you carry on talking, actually, we're recording this on a Tuesday. It releases on a Wednesday, and they do play Bayern Munich tonight.
Yeah,
so
we haven't seen that because it hasn't happened yet.
By the time this conversation goes out, they might have lost 6-0 to Bayern.
But still, let's focus it on the Premier League then. Yeah. City were incredible against Southampton, a team they'd actually lost to earlier on in the season in the Carabao Cup, I think.
Remarkable to think that.
Yeah. And they're in a really good run. Grealish in great form. Haaland's in great form. 8 wins in a row. They've settled in a system that seems to get the best out of everybody. You know, they've adjusted to the absence of Zinchenko with like Ake kind of making that left-sided defender role his own. They've got a lot of momentum. They've got a deeper squad than Arsenal. So it does feel like they will eventually pip them to it. And if that does happen, the kind of inclination for a lot of football fans will be to say that Arsenal have bottled it. Oh, bottles. It's still a good effort, though, isn't it? It's still a good effort.
It's one of his voices. Again. He's not another voice.
South London milkman.
That's it, yeah.
Impression. Oh, bottles. Oh, yeah.
Do you have a milkman?
I don't know. No. But if I did... bottles, mate, yeah, bottles.
But that won't be what happens. It will just be that Arsenal gave it a really good go and City have a better squad.
Sure.
Although, to be fair, like that kind of depends on the manner. So if they completely capitulate against bad teams, not the good ones, then I guess you could level that at them. But
what is your prediction then? Do you think Manchester City will?
Yeah, I think they'll do it on goal difference now.
On goal difference.
Yeah.
John, what about you?
Yeah, Man City feel as though they're in beast mode again, which always seems to happen at the end of the season. It all comes down to that fixture, doesn't it?
I think there's more points to be dropped.
Yeah.
And I think I'll just have a quick look at... We might need to edit this bit out while I do this, but I'll have a quick look at...
I'm sure the viewers will enjoy
they
watching.
Want to, the, watch
last time,
okay,
the last
cool.
time we were on this show together, you read out Arsenal's fixture list and me and JJ seemed quite nonplussed by it. We're like, well, what's interesting about that? And they have already dropped points, so...
There you go.
I think...
look at that, proven right once again.
Yeah.
That's why I've come back here, just so people can tell me
hated,
I'm correct.
Hated, adored, never ignored.
Never That's ignored, you. Yeah, except for mother.
City have got to play Brighton as well.
So a really interesting way of like using your phone, don't you? Is that just because
like
you're
this.
On a podcast?
Yeah. No, when I stand outside, I normally go, yes, hello. Yeah. So here's Arsenal's fixture list, remaining fixture list for the rest of the season. You ready?
I'm having such a weird sense of deja vu.
Yeah,
right
we've
now.
Done this.
A little
before,
bit of tense music for the audio only listeners. Steve Hankey here would be fantastic. West Ham, Southampton, Manchester City, Chelsea, Newcastle, Brighton, Nottingham Forest, Wolves.
Howls.
That's a tough.
Well, that's if they draw to. I'm assuming they draw to Newcastle and Brighton and lose to City.
Yeah.
The thing is, Arsenal only need to draw against Man City, right? And then win all of their other games.
True.
Easy.
Easier said than done.
Yeah.
I would say. Now Manchester City. Maybe a different sort of tense music, Steve? What do you think? Give him an extra job, have to find another
harbinger
type of music?
Harbinger of doom for the first one, but like harbinger of happiness for this one.
Okay, let's see. Manchester City, they on the 15th, which is 4 days' time, they play Leicester at home.
Then they are, oh, they've got the FA Cup, of course, and they've got the Champions League. They've got a number of fixtures more at the moment. Premier League only. Then Arsenal, Fulham, West Ham, Leeds, Everton. Then they're at home to Chelsea, and they're away to Brentford on the last day of the season. And I feel like there's a lot of easier fixtures in that list than there are in Arsenal's
list. You can't see any of those teams really giving them much fuss, can you?
Chelsea, maybe. Brentford's a sort of, the, you know, spring a surprise.
If Frank Lampard finds his magic wand, then yeah. Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. Otherwise, no chance.
Woof. What do you think then, John? Prediction, please.
Yeah, City are going to do it.
Okay. Well, there we go. Now we've thoroughly upset the Arsenal fans. Let's move on and upset another team. Yeah? After the break, we'll come back. And we'll talk more about another team, and then that'll happen.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Ah, returning. Who shall we cast our ire upon? It's Chelsea. Well, this is bad, isn't it? Wolves 1-0 Chelsea. But of course, the big story of the week. Daddy's home. Daddy's come home. He went out for cigarettes yeah. 2 years ago and he's come back and he's still as smart as ever. His daddy. Of course, by daddy, I mean Frank Lampard. Now, Frank Lampard, he's rejoined Chelsea interim coach, I believe, until the end of the season. Is that correct? Yeah. They used to call it caretaker, didn't they? But now, no, is that caretaker and interim is a different thing? Is it caretaker is when you just inherit it overnight because someone's gone.
I think
interim is when you're appointed specifically for a short period of time. Okay, fine. I've answered my own question. Fine.
Do you need us here?
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I probably could manage.
I mean, all we've learned today is that you were right about everything.
That's true. Yeah. Although I was wrong about how to say harbinger.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. What do you think about this then? Bringing Lampard back.
I just don't understand it, to be honest. Yeah. I understand why they got rid of Potter. I can understand bringing in an interim coach, but I think bringing someone like Lampard back makes it less likely that they can make smart decisions in the future. Now, it may be the case that they're not very likely to make smart decisions in the future anyway, given the current track record. But I suppose there's two options here. One is that Frank Lampard does badly, and I mean, nothing. It's arguably the easiest job in football right now because Chelsea are sort of, 9 points? They've got a 9-point buffer. Maybe it's less than that.
They are.
How far away
between
from
who?
Palace?
You mean the relegation?
Six points.
We're 6 points off them now.
Yeah, I'm not considering them as potential relegation candidates, but
they're currently
not
on 39 points after 30 games.
And you're on 33, right?
Nottingham Forest are on 27.
Now, I'm not worried about them getting relegated, but
they're
not going to drop below where they currently are, unlikely.
No,
although Ruben has a theory, which he will no doubt talk about
it's,
later.
It's worth saying they are 17 points off top four, so there's also
no... they're not going to get... So what is... Either. There's nothing at stake here, so in that respect, like, whatever, it's fine.
Daddy can have the run of the mill.
If he does badly, you sort of wasting good players and you raises the question, why not just keep growing Potter till the end of the season anyway?
Yeah, why not?
If he does well, you then have a situation where over the summer, the fans are just going to be pissed off if they bring someone else in.
Daddy's back for good.
Yeah. And so they've just, for me, it's just, okay, the reason they've done it is no doubt to get the fan base back on board because they seem very much not on board with the Todd Bowley project.
Yeah.
But I just think it makes it harder for them to make that smart decision in the summer.
It's a PR-driven decision, this to bring Lampard back, because the fans love him. But so, like, they've brought him in as, like, a vibes man.
Yeah.
And they will probably end up... Because I'm...
He's kind of like a Bez.
Yeah, with them...
With the Happy Mondays, yeah, you know, yeah, just to sort of like get the crowd
going.
Young,
you've got to.
Sorry,
I forgot. I've seen Peep Show, so I understand. That
See, we both get all of our cultural references from famous TV
from
shows.
Terrestrial television, yeah.
But, like, they'll probably bring him in once every 18 months to do this because Chelsea go through so many managers, despite the fact they're trying to change that culture. They've had three this season. But the thing is, there is not that much evidence to suggest that he's a good coach. Like, he didn't...
There is some to... There's a lot to suggest that he's a competent coach, though, at least for a short period of time.
Fine,
right?
But he's never actually massively, like, improved a team.
Is that true?
Well, people will point to his time at Derby County at a time
six
when...
6-6, lost the playoff final, had Mount Tamori and Wilson on loan.
That's what other people will also say.
He's come with bullets in his gun.
I mean, look, I'm happy to claim that Frank Lampard is not a good coach, so I'm happy to accept that as decent evidence.
Let me just offer an alternative before you continue talking. And I like to say this once every 4 weeks on the podcast. When we say that, we don't mean actually not good versus good, because obviously they're all excellent. They are managers, coaches at very senior. Don't shake your head at me, John McKenzie. Obviously, they shake their heads. He hasn't got a coaching badge. He's just pretended. They're coaches and managers at these top level teams. Even the Championship is extremely elite level of football. What we mean is relatively to Pep Guardiola, for example. Lampard hasn't shown that he's Pep Guardiola, but he has shown, obviously, that he's an extremely competent football manager because he's been a football manager at the top level.
That seems like a very low bar.
And has achieved par everywhere or like just kept them where they are.
So,
but just to finish my original point, the PR vibes...
Yeah, Joe, let him finish.
I would have let him finish if you hadn't have jumped in as well and also gone, yeah, he's shit, isn't he? Yeah. Let's get him.
No, but seriously, the vibes will only last as long as results improve. Yeah. So like... I saw so many Chelsea fans, fan pages, losing their minds with excitement that he'd come back. Mm. That Nunes goal goes in at Molineux and they're just miserable again.
Yeah.
And he will have to change the results for them to stay like kind of happy and keep that mood there. And it all will come basically down to this Real Madrid tie. If they get spanked by Real Madrid, then nobody's happy. And it's just as rotten as it was.
That's true. I mean, that is a true point. And thus, the kind of... The net of that really is that football is a very deeply stupid game, isn't it?
I was actually looking at the numbers. I think it was Nathan Clark, our good friend Nathan Clark, sent me the expected points from Understat for Arsenal and Chelsea since January the 1st. And we all know that Graham Potter's teams underperform their expected goals. But actually, since January the 1st, Chelsea were expected to pick up more points than Arsenal over that period. Isn't that
really
interesting?
Yeah. That is interesting.
It blew my mind.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know if they had a lot more games or something, but tweaking the numbers. But
imagine.
Yeah.
I guess we'll find out more about Chelsea and the Lampard project over the next few weeks. Suffice to say, Daddy's home. Now, what else should we discuss? Manchester United 2-0 Everton.
I feel like this is on the running order because you want to talk about it. This podcast is becoming you.
That's true. Well, I mean,
do you want me to ask you the question?
It's always been me, really, hasn't it?
Joe, you watched this game and you had some interesting thoughts about Bruno Fernandes.
I actually came up with an interesting question to ask you.
Oh, really?
Simply because Bruno Fernandes played a little deeper than I've seen him play for Manchester United. We won't linger on this game because it's not of huge consequence, but he played in an eight role alongside Scott McTominay, I think, and it was Sabitzer who played up more forward as the 10. Bruno Fernandes' kind of a game reminded me of late stage Rooney, sort of playing those kind of hero Hollywood passes.
Like Scholes kind of 09-10.
Vibe, exactly. Is this something that they've tried before? Or is this something that, I've actually missed a lot of games recently, I feel like.
Well, Ten Hag, I guess, is struggling with the fact that he's got Casemiro out on a suspension and Christian Eriksen injured. And he's been messing around with the midfield. And so, obviously, Man United have two... Well, they have midfield three. Usually you would consider them to have two eights and a pivot player. Mm. But actually one of the eights usually drops alongside the pivot player in build-up. You would expect a 10 to usually be like a more creative player, but he's used Scott McTominay there the week after the international break because he likes to, and we've seen him use Wout Weghorst there as well, he likes to have a good out-of-possession player in that sort of position as well.
Yeah.
And I think the general problem that Manchester United have been struggling with is how do you progress the ball? And
because Eriksen's been injured, of course, and he's the player who would normally play in that deeper eight role.
Yes, exactly, in the halfway between an eight and a 10.
Mm. So they've a nine.
Yeah, I suppose so.
An 8.5.
An 8.5.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, this is, I think, the next step in that evolution. But part of the problem with playing in that way is that Bruno Fernandes is maybe not the most press-resistant player, maybe not the best technical player in terms of holding the ball. And so what we've been seeing actually happening a lot is Luke Shaw inverting inside because he does have the ability to sort of play that pivot role a little bit better. Mm-hmm. And Bruno Fernandes then switching out into the wide channel just to give him a bit more space on the ball so that he can then play those forward passes. So whether or not we'll see this in the long run, I don't know, but it's all part of Erik ten Hag trying to find a solution to the fact that actually he has quite a limited skill set of midfielders, and when you have two of them out, he's actually struggling to get the upside there.
It feels like he wants a Bruno Fernandes in build up and a Bruno Fernandes in the number 10 position as well. Can't play him in both positions, but I do think it kind of works a bit better in possession to have Bruno a bit deeper and McTominay a bit higher up, because in the past, like especially under Solskjaer, when McTominay had played as that deeper midfielder, it felt like he would almost hide from the ball a little bit. And if that sounds a bit harsh, then he just wasn't that good at taking it on the turn and progressing it through the lines. So I do think that more advanced role where he can bomb up and down, use his athleticism and his height. Like the goal he scored against Everton was really good. Nice late run, lovely pass from Sancho. He's much better up there.
Box crashing.
Yeah. But I think I've been quite harsh on McTominay over the years because he's been kind of sold as like this all-round more defensive midfielder, but I think that's probably not what he's best at, and now we're seeing a slight different side of him. And all it took was two goals versus Spain, and then everyone was like, oh, he's the next Lampard.
Indeed. The narrative shifts. Yeah. Speaking of the narrative and speaking of something else that I saw last week that I had questions about, let's bring in Herr Stafford Bloor, Mr. Sebastian Stafford Bloor, to discuss the ongoing situation at Newcastle with us after this pretend cut that makes it look like it wasn't a cut. We're at this point in the show, we're joined by your friend and mine, Sebastian Stafford Bloor. Hi, Seb.
Hi, Joe. I am everybody's friend. Hello.
That's very presumptuous of you, isn't it? Although I did say that at the beginning. Speaking of friends, we all need friends from all across the world. Is that a good intro? Maybe it's not the best link. But anyway, there was a big story that dropped last week, Seb, written by Adam Crafton, released on The Athletic. Lots of emails. It's always fun when a piece has lots of emails in it. But why were these emails more interesting than the ones that I receive on a daily basis?
Well, I send you quite a lot of emails, so I would dispute that. But in this particular instance, these emails seem to describe the UK government's level of interest in the Saudi takeover of Newcastle, or the public investment funds takeover of Newcastle. And so Adam Crafton's reporting contains a whole bushel of emails which have been sourced from a public information request. And yes, they describe in some detail the level of detail in which, or the level of interest that the UK government had. And one of the problems beyond the sporting aspect of this is it flies in the face of what the UK government said at the time. So Boris Johnson was once asked about his role in the takeover and at a time when the Premier League was considering the takeover. And at the time he said that this was a matter for the Premier League and that it was an independent matter and that the UK government had no interest in it or was paying no part in it at all. And after Adam's reporting, Johnson was approached for comment again and said, well, that's a matter for government, isn't it? Which is a strange way of...
It is strange. Yeah. It's also worth saying, a part of Adam's reporting, I'll read it to you now. The Public Investment Fund is also the funding power behind the controversial LIV Golf competition, which we've talked about on the podcast previously with you, Seb, which is, of course, at the moment engaged in a legal dispute with the long-established PGA Tour in the US. And last month, the Premier League was urged by Amnesty International to re-examine assurances given by Newcastle's Saudi owners that the Gulf state would not have control of the club following the filing of a new court document. So I suppose the thing that's interesting about these emails is, as you state, is that, you know, despite the fact that we were kind of told at the time that the UK government had no role in this, really, that they appear to have had a role would presumably, again, suggest that the link between the Saudi state and the football club is there, even though they're saying it isn't.
Yes, I mean, that's a matter for the Premier League, Joe. But let me read you a text, which was first reported by the Daily Mail in June 2020. It's from Mohammed bin Salman to Boris Johnson. And it reads, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has opened its doors for the UK's investments in various sectors, initiated a mutually beneficial investment program with large amounts of funding. The Premier League's wrong conclusion will unfortunately have a negative impact on both our country's economic and commercial relations. Now, that's MBS.
That's a text.
That is a text reported by the Daily Mail.
Very formal for a text message, isn't it? Normally they would be more informal. But anyway, what does that mean, Seb?
Very difficult to know, Joe. It's a very vague situation, but it certainly seems to suggest a level of government intervention that previously we didn't believe to exist. And it obviously flies in the face and contradicts what Johnson has said in the past, what Johnson said in the House of Commons about government's intervention in what was a Premier League decision. Obviously, remember that the Premier League said that the reason they waived the takeover through was because they'd received legally binding assurances. And this reporting by Adam describes a situation in which government has shown the intention to impress upon the Premier League the importance of the takeover within the context of the overall economic relationship between Saudi Arabia and the British government. So what that all means, I'm not entirely sure.
Well, I mean, the obvious question is anything going to happen? Because, I mean, we had this conversation about LIV Golf a couple of months ago, and it seemed as though that shed new light on the reality of the relationship, and perhaps not. Now we're having this conversation, which again I think is a really good example of something which sheds new light on the relationship. Does anything happen as a result of that?
Really hard to say. So you can argue it both ways. You can take either perspective. So the LIV Golf situation seem to suggest that Yasser Al-Rumayyan, who is the chairman of Newcastle United, should be privileged within the scope of that LIV versus PGA court case because he was a member of government, that he was not just an average citizen.
Acting on behalf of a sovereign nation as well.
Exactly that. On the other hand, which seemed to be a kind of a smoking gun for people who wanted to find one, right? Whereas in this instance, the relationship between, or the implied relationship between the British government and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the kind of the meshing together of the various economic interests would seem to suggest that any action by the Premier League is also far less likely because it wouldn't seem to be in the national interest or the British national interest. Very, very hard to form a definitive conclusion on any of that. Also on the basis that all of this is unprecedented. From the takeover to the LIV Golf situation to the revelations reported by Adam, which are well worth a read if you get the chance, just because there's so much more than what we've described within them. It's an amazing bit of reporting, actually. But what happens next is there's no guidebook, there's no manual for how this will play out or even what the Premier League's role within it actually would be. When you have a sporting organisation that's a kind of a bit role player within something which is obviously much larger, it's very difficult to say legally.
Cool. Mm-hmm. All right, well, there we go. Seb Stafford-Bloor, thanks very much. It's lovely to see him, isn't it? Isn't it nice to see Seb Stafford-Bloor?
It is, yeah.
There he is.
Looking in a mirror.
And have we had him on the podcast since he's got his new glasses?
We have not.
Extra ability to see the detail there. And obviously also looks a lot like John McKenzie.
I can see, and I no longer have a headache sort of in return for that. I can actually see without experiencing pain. It's a lovely experience.
Seb and I did have a long conversation the last time we had a meeting about the experience of getting glasses for the first time when you're a little bit older.
Yeah.
Because you forget how beautiful the world is. And
did you not have them?
I didn't have them until I was about 28.
You strike me as someone who came out of the womb with glasses on.
That's just discrimination on the part of my general demeanor.
It's not discrimination, it's just rude. But
he's calling you a nerd.
He's calling me a massive neek, is what he's calling me.
What does that mean?
I think it's a portmanteau of the word nerd and geek.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine the kind of person that would know that and know the word portmanteau?
Well, look, if you ask me questions, I'm going to answer them. Sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah. That's why you employed me.
Well, say goodbye to Seb now.
Bye, Seb.
Bye, John.
I catch glimpses of him when we're having Zoom meetings, and I'm like, is that me?
I'm looking good. Yeah. Don't worry. You still look the same.
Thanks, Matt.
Now, listen, we'll be back after the break with more, but until then, and then I guess into the future, we'll see Seb Stafford-Bloor again. Bye, Seb.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/theathletic.
Okay, what a delightful break. A lovely break. Now, Leeds 1-5, Crystal Palace. Now, guten Tag and goodness me, what a result this was. A surprise result, even after the first half. This, of course, for less familiar listeners, is the Mackenzie Pinder derby here, where you've got old man Mackenzie, who's a Leeds supporter, and baby boy Pinder, who's a young whippersnapper Palace fan. The young, very happy today, John, weren't they? The old, dying.
Yeah, well, it's always nice to see the old. It's always nice to see the young happy, so I suppose it's the better way around. But yeah, when you get to my age, the chances of seeing Leeds win become fewer and fewer. And yeah.
Especially when you throw eight players forward at once.
Yeah, it was... What a weird game in many respects. I think the general consensus was the Leeds played quite well before their goal.
Yeah.
After the goal, the momentum sort of slightly shifted.
Because they went one up.
They went one up
and
from
maintained
from
that for yeah. almost the entire first half. Then Crystal Palace
equalized
at the death of half time.
The death of half time.
Yeah,
yes.
First half. I mean.
And then obviously the second half was a capitulation as we mentioned. But Leeds are an interesting proposition at the moment, because I think a lot of people have this narrative that Jesse Marsh is this counter-pressing coach who does lots of pressy stuff and actually was like defensively open. So you get upside from the counter-pressing, but actually downside from the fact that you often commit players into situations where your structure is just open to be attacked. That was how this game felt to me, weirdly. So Leeds, I thought, were pretty good in the first 20 minutes, largely because they were very good at putting pressure on Palace in their build-up, stopping them from getting the ball into the Leeds half. One of my friends who's on the All Stats On Week podcast looked at the high regains that both teams worked, and I think Leeds picked up about 15 high regains in the first 20 minutes, which is more than they picked up for the rest of the game after that. And after that point, it swung in favour of Palace, so Palace were winning the ball higher up a lot more. It felt to me very much like Leeds were able to be aggressive for the first 20 minutes, and as a result were able to largely control the game, keep the ball in the opposition's half and generate some chances. The intensity drops off after the first goal, and Palace are given more time and space on the ball, and as a result of that, they're able to start exploiting some of the defensive weaknesses that Leeds have. So it was an interesting game, I think, from the point of view of the narrative, because I think a lot of people have wanted to have this narrative that Jesse Marsh was here and Javi Gracia is here and that never the twain shall meet. But we've built a squad that is largely better in those intense moments of pressing than we have controlling the ball in possession.
Yeah.
And so, you end up with this situation where, yes, okay, maybe the manager might want to play more attractive possession-based football. But if you don't have the squad players to be able to do that, it doesn't really work. And so, the big question is, what happens in the summer? Do you give this guy a chance to like rebuild the squad in his own image, or do you?
Well, let's come back and talk about Leeds, because there's something else I want to ask you about as well. But let's go on to Crystal Palace for now, where Granddaddy's back, isn't he?
granddad is back.
Extra surprise.
It's genuinely like incredible, the complete transformation of this team. That's two games in a row they've gone a goal down and come back to win.
Mm.
And I was thinking, like, to what extent was this Palace being good or Leeds capitulating? And it does feel like they made it very easy for Palace to just cut through them. Like, there were so many counterattacks that were kind of 4v2, 3v2. And when you have players like Elise and Eze confident in form and fit, then they can do damage to kind of leaky defences. And Elise was in particular brilliant. He got 3 assists from open play and became the youngest player to do that in Premier League history.
Wow.
Which is pretty impressive.
That is impressive.
But so now it feels like, and this is a Crystal Palace without Wilfried Zaha as well. That used to be the kind of crutch of, I don't know, we hadn't won without him for, you know, 2 or 3 years or something ridiculous. Yeah. But now it does feel like there is a good foundation there to build on. Don't know if that'll be Hodgson. Most likely not. But it also feels like Gehi or Elise will probably have to leave in the summer so that we have some money to spend. So I'm going to enjoy this run while it lasts, because we've got a nice run in.
Yeah. It also seems like, you know, that's two victories on the bounce, right? And now Palace, 33 points, they're in 12th place. They are 6 points off the drop zone at the moment. And you just feel like
6 points off Chelsea.
And 6 points off Chelsea. You feel like maybe, I mean, that's not them safe, but at least with the current trajectory and the momentum.
Pretty much, yeah.
They have an incredible run as well.
Yeah, exactly. We've got Southampton next and then Everton.
Right.
There's just a lot of games where they could feasibly win.
Yeah.
Like watching that game felt like, other than like the big two, the top two at the moment, it feels like that team on their day can get a result against anyone in the league. Like,
I mean, I wouldn't go that far, but I'm not a Palace fan, so.
Well, no, but like that Palace performance, if they're all fit, like if Wilfried Zaha comes back into a team and they play like they do with that kind of confidence and verve, then they could nab a point against Newcastle, you know?
Maybe. They're not going to be playing Leeds every week, though, so.
Well, let's go back to Leeds, and we'll talk more about what they do or don't do in the future on future episodes of the podcast, John. But very specifically, something happened this week with related to a player transfer, which is very odd.
Yes, the Jean-Kevin Augustin transfer saga on.
Mm.
So for those people who don't know, Jean-Kevin Augustin was a player that we signed when we were in the Championship on loan, with an obligation to buy at the end of the season, but it was during the pandemic season. And when it got to the end of that season, Leeds refused to pay the transfer fee because he met the obligation on the basis of the timing of the contract and the way that the contract was written up. Because the season ended beyond the date on the contract where it said by this date, if Leeds have stayed up, then I've got promoted. I can't remember the details, but either way, he hit the obligation.
Point is, there was a minor, clerical discrepancy, which Leeds believed
meant that they didn't have to actually sign this player.
Yeah.
It was found later that they did have to pay for this player, and so Leeds have ended up paying £15 million to RB Leipzig, who the player belonged to at the time, as compensation for that.
By which time the player's already gone.
Yeah, so they've refused to, they've not played the player. He's gone off on loan somewhere. I think he went to France or something, maybe even on full transfer. But now it's raised its ugly head again, because the player's clearly sued for damages, so claiming that for loss of earnings, but also impact on future career prospects as well, to the tune of, I think, around £25 million. Sure. And so I think the club are going to contest it, but if it doesn't go through, which, given that the original court case did go through, it suggests that Leeds are going to end up paying £40 million for a player who played, I think, 48 minutes for us.
That's nearly £1 million a minute.
Yes.
I hope it happens, because that's quite a good YouTube title for a TIFO video in the future. The £1 million a minute footballer.
Give our ideas away.
Is this the worst transfer of all time?
Yeah, I think mine's better, but, you know.
This is very much an off-camera discussion.
Okay, fine. Well, anyway, that's Leeds and Crystal Palace. We'll move on now to quickly discuss Leicester. Now, Leicester, they're in real trouble, it would appear. They lost 0-1 to Bournemouth over the weekend. And there was a sort of interesting story movement yesterday, Ruben Pinder. It appeared for much of the day that Jesse Marsh might be the man replacing Brendan Rodgers at Leicester City. But this morning I woke up to Dean Smith. He was in my bedroom. He said, "I'm the new Leicester City manager. I'm here for a bit with Craig Shakespeare as my assistant, not Jesse Marsh." That's kind of odd, wasn't it?
What, the fact that he was in your bedroom?
Yeah, really weird.
Just to announce the news.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
I was nude.
Lucky him. It was. it's an odd one. Yeah, I think Leicester are kind of doomed regardless.
You think so?
It's so toxic there. Even now Rodgers is gone, the fact that they haven't bounced back with good result is concerning. I've spoken to a few friends who support Villa and Norwich, and I'm getting very mixed reviews of Dean Smith. There's a lot of justification for why he couldn't have kept Norwich up. But then also, if we remember, he kept Aston Villa up. Weird way of saying it.
That's strange.
Thanks to...
Yeah, how did you play with it, though? Just say it all again, but say it thank you to.
And if we remember Aston Villa, he kept them up.
You got it, man.
And he kept Aston Villa up. Thank you, too. I can't do it. It sounds ridiculous.
Who's it thanks to?
Well, I'll try and finish my sentence. He kept Aston Villa up because the goal line technology failed. Do you remember that? When the keeper carried the ball into the net against Sheffield United and didn't count as a goal.
Do you want to say thank you to the goal line technology?
Well, I don't really care whether Villa stay up or go down, to be honest. Is he good? Who knows?
Who knows?
He did all right at Villa, then kind of hit a... they stayed up, he kind of did all right, hit a ceiling. But then Gerrard did worse. Maybe he will keep them up. Who knows? Craig Shakespeare, I think, is a more important element of that appointment.
Big shout. The assistant's more important. I like it. Mm.
He's won a Champions League tie, hasn't he? Well, match, at least.
That's
Craig Shakespeare.
With Leicester.
16-17.
Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention.
Here he goes. Where'd you learn that? In a book, was it? Did you learn it in a book? Okay, fine. Anyway, we don't have time. We've run out of time. Sorry, Leicester fans, that we've run out of time and also that you're getting relegated. Sorry about that.
But focus on the positives. You're not getting Jesse Marsh, so you'll be fine.
Well, there's more salt here in the Deep Football Podcast. God, you hate all the coaches,
don't
you?
With
all
their salt.
List them. Who's the worst ones? Who do you hate the most?
Who do I hate the most?
Yeah. But hate with actual emotion and not one that you'll look at the camera afterwards and say, I was just joking. One that you actually hate.
Well, you're my manager and I hate you.
Let's discuss the relegation battle now. Crystal Palace, as we've already mentioned, they're top of the screenshot here, included by Steve Hanke, but I think we think they're safe. 31 points, Wolverhampton Wanderers, West Ham still deep in there as well, 30 points. I mean, it's a big, big week for David Moyes. Bournemouth, Leeds, Everton, Nottingham Forest, Leicester City, Southampton. Southampton, I feel like we've just kind of consigned. I don't know if that's fair. They're still very much within reach of exiting. 8 games left for most of these teams, 9 for West Ham.
You fear for West Ham.
Yeah.
You really do. Because they've also got a European tie to balance.
Yeah.
And they've got quite a difficult run of games. They're only 3 clear at the moment. They've still got to play Liverpool.
Oh, play the tense music, Steve. Yeah, okay, go.
They've still got to play Liverpool, Manchester City, Manchester United, and, of course, the mighty Crystal Palace. But
that's hard.
Roy Hodgson
and a few other teams that they probably could beat.
Right.
But I fear for them. And if they do go down, of course, they'll get nowhere near as much as they probably should for Declan Rice and other good players.
That's very much true. Okay, fine. Well, that's the Premier League done for. A suggestion of teams there that might go down. A suggestion of teams that might go up from the National League. The starring fixture of the weekend. Big in America, John. The National League. This was Wrexham 3-2 Notts County. You guys went and watched this together, didn't you?
At the pub. It was on the TV.
It was on the television in a pub. And that should give you some, you know, the National League. This is the fifth tier of football. It's on the TV. It should give you some estimation of the scale of this. Now, Wrexham and Notts County, I believe, both started the tie with 100 points. In the National League. Third place, Woking, 76. The difference is quite significant, isn't it? I can't remember who tweeted this, forgive me. Excellent tweet, someone pointing out that it is kind of a travesty that the second-placed team with over 100 points may well not make it through the playoffs.
And Brian Reynolds said as much in an interview with BT Sport. He said there should be more than one automatic spot.
He would say that, but he's also probably right. Yeah. Well, there we go.
Would have made it a lot less dramatic for his TV show, though, wouldn't it?
Well, it would. And the drama you reference, John McKenzie, is, of course, that Wrexham scored 3, Notts County scored 2. But Notts County had a penalty in 90+5 minutes, saved by Ben Foster, the draft-in celebrity goalkeeper.
The cycling goalkeeper.
The cycling goalkeeper.
The goalkeeper who occasionally uses a bike.
Yeah. Who I think I would imagine last night went to bed thinking, I've made a really good decision. I've made an excellent decision.
Just repeatedly saying, what a frigging save. What a frigging legend.
And it was a good save, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was a great game, wasn't it?
It was a fantastic game.
Everything happened. It was...
The standard were very high, I heard JJ was saying.
Yeah, well, Notts County play really good football. Wrexham, I think Wrexham got the game plan really, really well. They stopped Notts County from doing what they do so well. Notts County play possession football. They move. They're doing positional stuff in the National League, which is nuts. Wrexham really good. They stopped Notts County from being able to do what they do so well, and were trying to exploit their high line. They have a really high line, and they were just constantly trying to get Paul Mullen in behind, and obviously it went quite well. But Notts County actually went up through a free kick, so everything was just perfect. They went up through a free kick, probably not really deserving it. Wrexham then come out and score a goal early on in the second half, after Paul Mullen just fouls one of their centre backs, runs through and scores, but it's allowed to.
It's the National League.
Yeah, and then they go and score at the. Wrexham score again, a legitimate goal, just a really nice, again, getting over the back line, hitting Mendy. The ball across the box to the left back, Mendy. But it looks like game over. But then Kyle Cameron pops up at the back post because. Wrexham starts sitting deeper.
Yeah, allows this is what Notts happened County. In the game.
This was
isn't
exciting.
It? Yeah,
and they got the ball to the back post. I think it was Sam Austin really changed the game for Notts County, but also Wrexham was sitting deep, 2-2, and you think, oh, you know, the game on now. This could go either way. This is exciting. Immediately, Wrexham just have a defensive mix up, mess up.
Out of nowhere, Stan Lee.
Stan Lee, that's right. Spider-Man,
the creator of Marvel.
Actually, this is Elliot Lee, who is the son of Rob Lee, who used to play for Newcastle.
Oh.
But the ball comes in, but the defender just kind of passes it back. He tries to flick it with the back of his heel, just plays it straight to Paul Mullen, who can just lay it off to Guy. So immediately, it's back to 3-2. Get to extra injury time, and then they win a penalty to make it go 3-3, and the penalty is saved. So it was just
high
a really
drama.
Great end-to-end game where anything could have happened. It was disappointing that Notts County weren't able to show how good they can be, but I thought it was a really good game plan from Wrexham, and it was just a great advertisement for the lower leagues.
Well, also, I mean, I am unironically excited to watch that bit of season 2 documentary.
I haven't watched.
So this is technically a spoiler for you, isn't it?
It is a spoiler. I don't know anything else.
You don't need
that
to
happens.
Watch it now, because I gave you the most exciting, dramatic reading.
Have you not seen any of it?
Is it good?
Do you know what? It is good. Mm. It is good, and it also it's quite creatively made. It's not like the other ones.
Any Latin phrases in it?
There's plenty of Latin.
Oh, really?
In there. You'll love it.
Yeah.
There's so. In fact, I had to turn the subtitles on because of how much Latin there was in the Wrexham documentary.
That was Welsh.
Yeah. Well, indeed, it was. There we go. It's all the same, isn't it? Really. Dwyn Hoffi Peldroid. Hey. Mm. Dwyn Ddim and Hoffi Peldroid, really though, because you know it's very boring.
Hoffi coffee. Okay,
that's that. And obviously, worth saying that the season is not yet over. Wrexham 3 points ahead now, as we alluded to before, only one promotion place. So it's really hotting up for the end of that documentary that we'll all watch in about a year. Okay, all that's left for me to do is to say thank you to Baby Boy Pinder.
Thank you.
Go on, do it.
And Jonathan Doc McKenzie.
Yeah.
Woof. There he goes.
Woof, woof.
Sorry, it's been a long time. Oh, dear. Seb Stavablor for joining us earlier. Guten Tag. Muchas gracias. No, that's the wrong language. Dankeschön. Dankeschön, Herr Stavablor. And, of course, to producer Steve Hankey. Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
And to video producer Jamie, who's had his hand up in the air the whole time. He's resting his hand very high up in the air. Strange. What a strange young man he is. There we go. Fine. Listen, we'll be back next week with more from football. Of course, the Champions League's happening. Maybe we'll talk about that. And other footballs. Until then, goodbye.
The Athletic.